Hi everyone, welcome back to RM Podcast FL. This is your host Romina. Before we get started, I wanted to take a moment and thank everybody that has reached out and supported this podcast so far. This is a self-sponsored podcast and everything is worked by me, Romina. So if you can please take 5 seconds of your time and share your favorite episode or even our main page on your social media platforms, that would be greatly appreciated. Also, feel free to talk to your friends, your family, your coworkers, anybody that you like to about our podcast. And as always, besides our website, www.rmpodcastfl.com, now you can also find us on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, Stitchers Radio, and Podbeans. Without losing any time, let's jump into the bio of today's guest and then the interview. I hope you guys really enjoy it. Today's speaker is very special. He is a professor of business and employment law at Florida State College of Jacksonville, the same college that I currently attend. There he teaches business law, employment law, and labor relations management in the bachelor's degree. Dr. Slenz is a practicing attorney licensed in Florida, and he also serves as a judge in the juvenile program for teen court of St. Johns County here in Florida and provides pretrial mediation services. He's also a certified investigator and agency decision writer. Prior to becoming a college professor, Dr. Slenz completed a 30-year career in the professional and leadership roles and as senior executive CEO with a $70 billion national service provider. He is also an author. You can find his book on Amazon, The Professor's 1 Minute Guide to Stack Management. That's the title of the book. This is a longer podcast compared to the typical ones, as we got a little bit more in details towards everything. I learned a lot throughout this conversation, and I hope you guys learn at least one new thing, like I say every podcast. But most of all, I hope you guys enjoy it. So without losing time, let's dig right in. Today, we're with Professor Harvey. Hi, sir. How are you today?
I'm doing great.
Awesome. I'm smiling because you always have this positive energy on you, and you always just makes people laugh around you. I remember you did like a stand-up one time.
I have done stand-up comedy in clubs.
Yeah. How do you still do it?
I did it for 2 years. I've been busy and haven't done it for about a year now.
Nice. So do you still like work on new materials and stuff sometimes?
It kind of comes to you.
Okay. I hope you have one of those moments during this interview too, because that would be really cool.
Okay.
Awesome. So we'll get started with, if you just want to tell me a little bit about your current career. Like, was law something that just came very natural to you? Were you obsessed with being a lawyer? Was there like a big life goal? Like, how did you get to that career?
Well, my mother says I started out in law at age 2 because she would be doing something in the kitchen, uh-huh, and I would go pacing back and forth at age 2 and telling her things. She couldn't understand it all, but she said that I was really doing a lot of trial work back then. So I probably had that inclination back then, but I really looked at a lot of things. In, mm-hmm, fact, my first career when I got out of college was in management, and then I went into industrial engineering, mm-hmm, which I did for many years, 8 or 9 years. Then I went to law school while I was still working for the same employer. I went to law school at night, and then I got into law and then senior executive status with my employer, where I had up to 5,000 employees and about a $300 million budget every year. So it's kind of morphed along, and now after that retirement, I'm back to doing a lot of law now, mm-hmm, and I'm also a judge, a mediator, a few other things.
So you said after the retirement, did you retire and decide to go back to work?
Yes.
You did?
I couldn't stand it.
Were you just bored?
Yes.
Oh my, so you're always running, so you cannot just, sit down for a while.
I'm like a shark. If I stop moving, I die.
Oh my goodness. So you did mention that you're a judge as well for, mm-hmm, the juvenile system.
Right.
And you also work as a mediator.
Right. Pre-trial. I work as a mediator in the Fourth Circuit and Seventh Circuit, which basically is from here down to Daytona, mm-hmm, and then west to Palatka area.
I see. So as a mediator, you probably should be really good at negotiations and kind of just relaxing situation.
There's an art to it.
So without realizing, we kind of negotiate, like everybody negotiates daily. Like we either negotiate with a post that we put on social media to be liked, or we either negotiate and try to make the hiring manager like us and offer the job that we want, or even negotiate with our partners trying to get things our way.
Yes.
So what are some tips and tricks that you can give us towards becoming a better negotiator?
Two things. Number one, be likable.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're not likable, you're not going to get anywhere. And that's some of the soft skills that we talk about frequently, where you have a high EQ, not IQ, emotional intelligence, where you know you can kind of size up the other party pretty quickly, and you work at their level so that they feel comfortable around you. Then if you're working with their level, then you can try to get your points across, but do it in a way that's comfortable to them. So if you're talking to someone, a panhandler on the street, then you can talk to that person. Then you can go inside a building and talk to a corporate CEO on that person's level. And you're equally good at both. So that's an important thing, is to have those personal skills, those soft skills, where you can get along with people. The other soft skills are things that sometimes we don't emphasize, things like be on time or early, be prepared. And that's one of the biggest things in mediation, is I come in prepared all the time. I know exactly what the case is about, and I'm ready. I know at least as much about it as one of the attorneys will, and maybe a little bit more, because I want to know what's going on before I walk in the room. And then the other thing I'm careful about as mediator in negotiating is I will do nothing but ask questions. Of course, that got Socrates poisoned, but with the Socratic method. But I'll ask questions of both parties and say, well, you're proposing we do this, but if you don't get a settlement, what do you plan on doing then?
Okay.
Do you plan on going to trial? Yes, I'm going to go to trial. Well, if you go to trial, how much is it going to cost you? I don't know. So I turn to the other lawyer and I'll say, how much is it going to cost your client to go to trial? Oh, he said, it's going to cost them $10,000 or $15,000.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, you know, that's a good reason right here to settle if you've got some agreeable terms for settlement. So we talk about things like that are realistic. So being prepared and having a friendly attitude are two very important things.
I like that. So it's not like you cannot get it your way, but you, instead of spending that $15,000 on trial, why not kind of meet in the middle and actually get the party what they want?
Well, now that's an important point when you say meet in the middle, because sometimes meeting in the middle might work. And for me, meeting in the middle is the last hope. Because if we get it down to where it's just money and nobody can agree on anything else, one guy says, I want $10,000 from you, and the other one says, I only give you $5,000. They say, okay, guys, let's forget about the whole mediation. Let's forget about what it's all about. You want to pay $5,000, he wants you to pay $10,000. We can settle this thing real quick by just saying, let's pay $7,500. And then they said, well, why should we do that? I said, because you're never going to come to an agreement. And I can promise you that if you go to trial, it will cost you more than $10,000 apiece. So this is your opportunity to be stupid. And they usually laugh. And then I say, so you can do whatever you want. And on behalf of the Bar Association, we hope that you go to trial, because there's a lot of attorneys out there that need that $10,000. So we hope you go to trial. But in your best interest, the best thing to do probably is going to be to settle it for $7,500. Because even if you win the $10,000 and you pay $10,000 to get it, you're back at zero. And the one who loses is minus $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way I try to sell it. But I don't come in with a predisposition about who should win. I just want to point out to them what they can do and why. They have to make the decision.
How did you even get into mediation?
It's a natural offshoot from law. And I like to do that because it's a much happier outcome for the parties. If they feel like they have some control over the outcome, it's a lot better than walking in front of a judge having 30 minutes. You make your pitch for 10 minutes. The other person makes their pitch for 10. Then the judge talks for 10. and either you win it all or you lose it all. It's like going to the roulette wheel in a in a casino. And so people feel a lot more comfortable and satisfied if they can have some say in how it's going to come out.
I see.
So it's just very, I also do arbitration.
Okay.
So the difference between arbitration and mediation, I don't make the decisions, they do, but I point out things to them. Arbitration, I say, okay, I'm going to make the decision. You tell me your side, the other mm-hmm. person tell me his side, I'll make the decision.
I see. So there is a big difference from for both of them.
One of them is Mr. Rogers, the other one is Darth Vader.
So you're also a professor for business and employment law at Florida State College of Jacksonville. I know majority of the population is employed somewhere, and sometimes they feel like the company or the manager acted wrongfully. Sometimes they feel like the HR, it's still not there to help them out. Like, where do these employees find the right information to know their rights, and what is the next step for them to follow?
Well, because somebody feels that their rights are not being recognized does not mean that that's correct. Because a lot of people believe they understand what's right and what their rights are and what their rights are not. And very often they find that they're not getting the correct view of it. There's lots of examples of that. So the first thing that I would recommend people do is to talk with HR
mm-hmm.
and say, well, what is the rule on this and why? And then let HR talk, because generally human resources will play it down the middle. They'll talk, and they won't necessarily, they're not going to say compromise. They're going to say, well, here's the rule and here's why the rule's there. And then the question you ask yourself is, all right, if this is the rule in the organization, did I have the opportunity to be made aware of it? Did they tell me this rule is in place? So if the rule is that you don't go out on a smoke break during the day, and then someone dings you for going out on a smoke break, would you say that that's a unfair practice, or would you say that it's reasonable for a person to recognize you don't go out on a smoke break, just wander out of the building? And that's where you would go to HR and say, what's the rule on this? And they mm-hmm. would say, well, we don't have a rule, but generally speaking, you don't go wandering out of the building without checking with your supervisor
yeah.
first. So that, and they might say, well, that's unfair. Okay, well, if you want fair is something that occurs every fall at the fairgrounds, and it involves a tilt-a-whirl and a pig.
That is so true, though, because a lot of people sometimes they feel like they're being punished or they're not being treated right just because they were not aware of the policy. And that's one thing that I love doing from time to time with the company that I work at. I just go on their HR policy and I just start reading. Mm-hmm. I start asking questions.
The other thing you can do is you can also go on the internet.
Yeah.
And just say, if you pick a subject and just say, can my boss fire me for no reason at all? That's a good question, right?
Can they?
Well, what do you think?
I don't think they can.
Well, in Florida and 49 other states, they can.
Really?
All 50 states. Unless you have a contract with your employer, or unless you're protected by a union which has a contract,
mm-hmm.
you can be fired for a good reason, bad reason, or no reason at all. So if you're working in a job and the boss comes in and says, Romina, I would like to put my daughter in the job that you're in because she's going to be running the company someday. Well, great, I'll move over to the other job. No, we don't want you around, so you're fired. And you say, well, I was doing a good job. Yeah, you were doing a great job. Now my daughter's going to do a great job. Well, can't I have a job here? No. Adios. Now, they can do that very easily, and it's perfectly legal. So employment at will is something that a lot of people don't really recognize is the rule in all 50 states. So unless you have a contract personally, or you are covered by a union, which gives you a blanket contract,
mm-hmm.
employment at will is the rule.
So you would suggest somebody to do their research before they start employment at a certain company?
Well, you can go ahead and almost everybody has employment at will.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't really need to try to find somebody that doesn't, because they're not necessarily going to say, hey, folks, we have job promises here.
Yeah.
Because then they...
But come on in.
Yeah. Well, they would have people who would say, oh boy, I'm not a very good employee, so I think I better go to work there.
Goodness.
But employment at will is something that surprises a lot of people because they think you have to have a reason to fire them. And the answer very clearly is, in my 38 years of being an employment lawyer, the answer is no, they don't. Good reason, bad reason, or no reason at all, according to the Supreme Court.
Unless you have a contract or you're part of a union.
Right.
Okay, I learned something.
Okay.
So for my listeners, I say I want them to learn at least one new thing, but I'm learning a lot myself too, so that's why I love this podcast. So my next question, for years now, you also serve as a judge on the juvenile system, like we said, Diversion program, the teen court for St. John's County here in Florida. Is there a teen that stand out to you particularly that you might have seen them when they were in trouble at one time and then they just kind of flipped everything and became the super version of themselves? Like they just changed their lives around.
There've been a few. Okay. A lot of them don't necessarily want to come back into court, so we don't see them. Mm-hmm. But the idea behind the program is this is for teenagers who are first-time offenders.
Okay.
They can be anywhere from 19 down to, we've had them as young as 8 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
So we had an 8-year-old who stole a car.
What?
Stole a car, stole the laptop in the car, plus the money, took the car, put it somewhere else. So
8-year-old?
8-year-old. So that's, he was an 8-year-old. So that's kind of the range we've handled, and we handle real cases. These are real cases. These mm-hmm. are not just play cases, and we've had people who burn animals and get in trouble for that. We've had different sex crimes of one type or another, fights with other students or fights with their teachers. So theft, burglary, all those sort of things, breaking into people's houses. And I remind them that's a really good way in Florida to get killed when you break into somebody's house at night, because at least around here, almost everybody's armed.
Correct.
So you have to keep that in mind. But what we try to tell the folks is, if you come in, you're charged right now with a low-level felony mm-hmm. or you're charged with a misdemeanor. If you come into our program and you do our program for a year, then you will not have a record of a criminal offense. And that's very important for getting a job, because
correct.
There's so many people applying for good jobs that one easy way to rule people out of a job is to look to see if they have a criminal record. Say, sorry, we've got 150 people applied for this job, and
you have a criminal record.
Yeah,
so.
You're one of the 25 who have a criminal record, so you 25 are out automatically.
I see.
And when I said 150 people applied, mm-hmm. that's not at all uncommon. There's typically over 100 people applying for every job.
Oh, wow.
We had a faculty job at FSCJ, mm-hmm. and it wasn't particularly a high-paying job either. It was just fairly ordinary, and we had 113 people apply for it. So, pretty common.
That's pretty common. I always wonder what were the exact stats, like how many people apply for one job, because you always think maybe it's like 10 or 15, but you don't realize you have so many like recruiting websites out there today that it's just so many.
It depends a lot too on what the requirements are for the job.
I see.
If we say we have to have a PhD economist or a PhD finance specialist, then we don't have 100. We'll be lucky to have 5 or 6. But if we say that we need somebody who's got a master's degree in history, mm-hmm. then they come in by the busload.
Yeah.
So that's the difference there. But in teen court, the idea there is give people the opportunity to turn themselves around.
And you've seen a lot of that happen.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of them who they don't become miracle workers, but they do get out of trouble. They go back and they work with their parents and they do okay. Sometimes we see that the child got in trouble because his parents weren't a very good role model and didn't take care. Other times we see the parents doing everything they should as well as anybody could, but the child is still rotten. So,
is it more because they get influenced by their friends?
I don't know. Maybe it's just internal to them.
Yeah.
Some people are just not very good people. And we see them sometimes, like the ones that burned the animals, three of them.
Oh, my goodness.
You have to have a special place in your head for going around burning animals. And for those folks, we said, what I ruled was, I said, you have to do this and that, but in addition, we're going to require that you go to a psychiatrist for 6 months.
That is just very cruel. I can't believe that.
So that's examples in teen court. But it's a very, very good program, and I encourage anybody to try to find the local teen court program in their mm-hmm. community and visit it, because it's generally open to the public.
Is it?
Yeah.
Where is the one for Duval County?
A lot of them are down at the county courthouse.
Okay.
But you can just get online and Google Duval County Teen Court.
Mm-hmm.
You'll come up with an entirely big website that'll tell you all about it.
I would want to go one time and just see, because it's open to the public, you said. So.
It is in my court,
and I
presume it is in most others, too.
Okay. Yeah, I have to definitely look into that. My next question is, you have so much going on at once. I mean, you are a professor, you are a judge, you are a mediator, you have a family, you have little minions that run around the house.
Grandchildren.
Grandchildren, yeah. So you are so busy, but you also make time to do everything. What motivates you? Like, what fuels you?
Well, in addition to the items you listed, I also am a partner in a treasure hunting company, and that keeps me kind of busy from time to time. It comes in spurts of activity. Sometimes it'll be very quiet, sometimes it'll be very active. But me and several other people are owners of a treasure hunting company with a boat that's 74 feet by 32 feet.
Okay.
So we're out there. We have divers that work for us, and three stories high on the ship. So it's a pretty good sized ship. And we go out looking for Spanish galleons in particular. And I think that's kind of instructive about the way that we went through it, because we didn't try to get something that would be good for any kind of treasure hunting. We specialized in Spanish galleons. The reason we did was all Spanish galleons had treasure in them. Now, you don't go after pirates and look for their treasure, because pirates never had much. Anytime they would get something, they would go spend it on wine and women. But the Spanish galleons would bring gold, silver, and emeralds back from the New World going back to Spain. And in 1715, for example, on July 28th, they encountered a hurricane and 11 ships sunk in the same day. And when they did, there was several billion dollars worth of treasure that went down. One of them that we're working now is just off Amelia Island. It's worth between $2 and $10 billion. So we're pretty well sticking with that one for the time being. But those are examples of things you can do. We did the research first. We didn't just throw money into it.
Correct.
And by comparison, there's another company over in Tampa who did buy the stuff first, and they got a big company with a lot of shareholders. They got a whole bunch of equipment that can dive down to 3,000 or 4,000 feet deep, but there's nothing down there at 3,000 or 4,000 feet. All the money is in the shallows. So they have a big, wonderful set of equipment, but there's not much use for it.
Yeah. That's interesting.
So doing the research is what's really important, too. One other thing that I think is important to get out here is that it's okay to fail.
Mm-hmm.
One of my kids asked me that one time. They said, what's the most important thing I should remember? I said, you should remember that most people don't succeed because they are afraid to fail. And I'm not afraid. I walk in and embrace failure constantly, because it doesn't worry me.
Mm-hmm.
Give you an example. When I was taking the law school admission test, there were 1,300 people who took the law school admission test. I heard that about 90% finished it, but about 50% of those 1,300 made an acceptable score. So that's around 650, mm-hmm. 650 people. And they were all going to go to law school in the Louisville area where I was living at the time. So out of 650, only 250 applied to the law school. And most of the ones that I knew who didn't apply, why didn't you apply?
Yeah.
They said, well, I'm just afraid I wouldn't get in. Well, guess what? By not applying, you guaranteed you won't get in.
No, it's a no already, so why don't you try it?
So, and they said, well, yeah, but I just didn't want to be embarrassed by not being accepted. I would rather not try than to try and not get in. I don't want to fail. Okay, whatever way you want to do it. 250 applied. There was 150 accepted mm-hmm. into the school for that year. Of the 150, only 105 showed up for the first day of class. And out of that, only 29 graduated.
And this is 1,300 people took the test at the very
1,300, beginning. Yeah, took the test. 29 graduated.
Oh, wow.
But all of that was, almost all of that was self-failure. They did not want
they
to
They don't
want
to put themselves out there.
They don't want to take a risk that somebody's going to say, ha, 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 you failed. Well, I can give you a list of things that I failed at, and it doesn't bother me a bit.
Yeah.
And that's something I really encourage people to think about, is that. The other thing that I would mention, too, is that don't think in terms of a career.
Mm-hmm.
Because a career is really an outcome, not a goal. I'll give you an example. If you go to college and you get to be very good at analytical math
mm-hmm.
and things like that, that is what your skills are. So you might get into something that involves engineering or some activity of that nature. But your career is whatever uses your skills. So think in terms of what are your skills? And what I tell my students a lot is, what can you do? And I'll pull out money out of my pocket. I'll say, here's $300 cash. Mm-hmm. Tell me what you can do that would make an employer want to give you $300 a day just to be here. Well, I can manage. Say, well, you don't think they've got managers where they are?
Mm-hmm.
What can you do special? Well, I can answer customer complaints. You don't think they've got people now who can manage customer complaints? So tell us exactly what your skills are. And therefore, when you start college, get a big binder. And in that big binder, keep examples of some of your best work, your best writing, your best analytical work, so that you can show potential employers, this is the work I can do. This is the work I did do. It's better than just saying, yeah, I did this. If you can show them, it makes a lot of difference.
That's a very good advice, because the graduation season was just around the corner too. So a lot of people now, they're job hunting, or maybe they started before graduation, mm-hmm. they might be struggling to get that interview. So maybe things like that, when they go to the interview, would absolutely help to make the difference compared to every other person having a cover letter and a resume and just answering the questions.
Yeah, if you go walking in with evidence,
mm-hmm.
you go walking in with a binder that says, okay, here's a tab for writing. This is stuff that I've written, including memos and big papers. There's a big demand for people that can write big documents, 100, 200 pages,
mm-hmm.
big demand for those. I know a lady that I worked with in Leesburg, Virginia, who makes a very good living writing big documents for contractors for the government. And she charges $50,000 or $60,000 for each one. So it takes her about 3 months to do it.
To finish the whole project. To write everything.
Yes, yes. So that's an example of it. But that's why the skills are more important than a career. Because the career is somewhat dependent upon what's going on in the economy and in the world.
I see.
If your career was that in General Electric, you were a line worker on the assembly line, like the ones that I worked with, or the ones that I knew when I was living in Louisville, they were making good money. In today's money, it would be around $70,000 as a line assembly line worker. But then automation came in and took over all those jobs. And so their career just went poof. It's no longer there. And it didn't go to China or Japan or any place like that. It just went up in smoke. And so that career went away. So you got to think in terms of what is your skill. That's important.
That's a really good point. That's a really, really good point. Thank you for sharing that. Because you always, it just kind of tricks stuff in my brain to like, why are you special? What can you bring to the tables other cannot bring? You always should have that student mentality, and you always should learn and improve yourself compared to just being happy to where you at, or just, you know, just always learn more.
And know why what you're learning is worthwhile to somebody else. One example that I would say is that you ought to have three jobs all mm-hmm. the time. And I've had, by the way, I've had three jobs from the time that I was like 12 years old until I was 39. When I was 39, I just took one job. It was just so consuming. Mm-hmm. I could only do it and just barely do it. And then when I retired from my major employer, then I came back and I was teaching, practicing law, treasure hunting, doing all the other stuff. Mm-hmm. So I was back to four or five jobs and I felt more comfortable. But one of the things that you do is you say, I want three jobs. I want one job to pay the bills.
Mm-hmm.
I want one job to increase my skills. And the last one, I want one job to give me thrills.
Okay.
And if you do that, then you'll be pretty well rounded. So one of them you're doing for the money.
Mm-hmm.
One of them you're building skills so that down the road you'll have better skill and more money. Mm-hmm. And then you got to have one that really just excites you. Like in my case, the ones that excite me are treasure hunting
mm-hmm.
and the teen court. So that's what makes a difference to me.
Nice. So you also are an author, though.
Yes.
So the book that I know you wrote, The Professor's 1 Minute Guide to Stock Management. I'm on my 20s, and I'm not very well educated for stock as much as I would love to. But what are some tips or advice that you would give to somebody on their 20s or even later on the age, but towards investment or savings? Because we run across people that just spend their money like it's nothing when they've worked so hard for it. What are some tips you'd give us towards money managing?
Well, we teach this in the Financial Skills Academy at the college,
mm-hmm.
and we were so intense on it that we created the Financial Skills Academy without the college even knowing about it. And we didn't take any money,
uh-huh.
and we started it 6 years ago, and we've now trained, through our program, we've trained about 1,600 people, students, employees, outsiders who've come in and taken the courses for about 18,000 hours worth of education.
Mm-hmm.
And we've spent a grand total of $300 in that 6 years. And that was all for our certificates. It goes on people's transcripts. And that's how seriously we take it. I think that if I were telling somebody about investment now, I'd tell them a couple of things. One, if you are in your 20s or 30s or even your teens, congratulations. You are fabulously wealthy right now. You're very wealthy because you got the one thing that is the ultimate wealth. You know what that is?
Time.
Time. Yes, time. If you're 25 years old, my God, you've got probably 70 years at least that you're going to be around before you croak. Okay? So that's very good news. You can spend that 70 years doing a lot of things. What we calculate is we say between the years of 18 years old and 78 years old, you will have 275,000 hours that you're awake and that you're not having to do things like take showers, which we appreciate, and do things like that. So you'll have all that time on your hands. You can spend it learning, which means you'll be earning more per hour,
mm-hmm.
or you can be having fun, you can be making memories, you can be making babies, you can be all kinds of things. So think about that 275,000 hours that you've got. Then when you get to be my age, you don't have 275,000 anymore. You might have 20,000 or something like that. So that's what you have, is you have the hours. The second thing that I would say is that don't try to overguess investments at this point. If I were to talk to somebody, I've got some grandchildren who are in their late teens, and I tell them, when you start investing, and you should start right away, put the money in a very simple mutual fund. and it should be simply the total U.S. stock market. Vanguard Investments has a good one, and Vanguard almost charges no expense at all for doing it. So you can put 50% of the money you've got to invest in the U.S. total stock market fund, and that'll tend to grow, and every year you can add a little bit more to it. The other 50%, put it in the total world stock market, and then it'll have all the other countries in the world will be in that. And so it's either going to be the U.S. or the world, or both is going to go well. Now, some people say, well, how about if I had it in gold? Okay? Answer is, gold doesn't go up. If you buy gold and then you try to trade it, you will lose your pants. That's been proven time and time again. Real estate, you don't make money on real estate, because real estate does not go up faster than the rate of inflation in the long run. There was a little blip there when there were so many baby boomers being born. But when you take that out of the equation, long years out, there's not going to be any value in buying real estate and watching it appreciate. And if you're a flipper, if you think you're going to buy a property and flip it, then my theory is just go ahead and give away everything you own and just save yourself the aggravation, because that's where you'll end up. Flipping does not work in the long run. It's like flipping a coin and saying, heads I win, tails I lose. You keep flipping, you keep getting heads and saying, this is great.
Yeah.
Eventually, you get a tail. So that's what I say, is just put it in that. Now, some people say, I'm going to put it in bonds where it's safe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's safe, but you're going to safely lose money every year, because it'll be less than the rate of inflation that you'll make. So every year, if you have $100, it'll go down to 99, then 98, 97. Put it in the stock market. That's the best one over the years, and that's what I would do. That's my advice on investment. But the main thing is, save. Whatever you put it in, just don't spend it all.
Always saving, too, it's important. Not even investing on stock, but always having that side.
Yeah, because if you have savings, let's say that you've got savings, and you're not, you need to have savings first. But if you have, let's say, $1,000 or $2,000 just around in your bank account or whatever, then if you have to have your car repaired, you can go out and have your car repaired.
Correct.
And that's more important than investing, really. You should have that money first, is the money for emergencies. And once you've got that, then you can talk about investing. But first thing is to have the emergency money.
I feel like we covered a lot of information. I learned a lot more towards investment, so I'm definitely going to go ahead and look into it even more and do more research, because I do have like the employee benefit, I have my Roth IRA, I'm not invested to like stocks yet, and that's where I kind of want to learn more about it. That's why I even asked that question too. But it is a good way to have that passive income while you're just sitting there, and then long term you can always just, you know, rip up the benefits.
If you invest $5,000 a year starting at age 23, and you do it for 5 years, $5,000 a year for 5 years, then at age 28 you stop and you never put another penny in it, but it continues to earn money going forward. At age 28 you never even look at it again. By age 65 you'll have $1 million.
Oh wow. So 5 years, 5,000, so 25,000 total. That's it.
Yes.
And just let it sit there, accumulate interest over the time.
Well, not interest. It'll be growth, earnings, dividends, but it'll be the same as interest, except it's a lot more than interest. But you'll make $1 million by the time you're 65. Now, if you do that 25, that's what you'll get. If you want to wait till you're 35, then to get to $1 million, you're going to have to put a lot more money in. 45, you're going to have to put triple. From 25 to 35, you have to triple the amount you put in. From 35 to 45, you have to triple it again, 9 times the 25. At 55, you have to triple it again.
So this is the age, the young age. That's where you definitely have to think of it, when a lot of people are not thinking of it. because they just get graduated, they have their student loans.
There's plenty of things you have to do, and yeah. sometimes you're just to the point where you can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
But keep in mind that the best asset you all have is time.
Time. That is so true. Yep. That one thing that you'll never get back is time.
And some people say, well, I want to invest in commodities. And I'll say, great. You want like pork bellies or something? And, well, I just don't know what to invest. I'll tell you what to invest in. What do you like to drink?
Mm-hmm.
And they'll say, Coke. All right. Wait till Coke's on sale. When it's not its normal $5.50 or $6 for a 12-pack. Wait till it's on sale for $3. Then go buy all you can afford
mm-hmm.
and bring it in, put it in your living room, and cover it with a tablecloth. And now you've just made a whole bunch of money because you've doubled your money in Coke as a commodity. Right? Guaranteed money.
Yeah.
That's the way to do it. Buy meat that is on sale for 50% off, you're guaranteed because you're going to eat that meat either way, whether you have to pay full price or half price. Those are the things to think about. I was in the coffee line a couple of weeks ago with a mm-hmm. friend of mine, and he's a very much a multimillionaire, well over $10 or $15 million. He and I were standing in line to get some coffee at a place in Amelia Island,
mm-hmm.
and there are some kids in front of us. And one of them dropped a quarter, and it rolled a little bit under a counter. So the guy in front of me, my friend, said to the young man there in front of him, he said, hey, you dropped a quarter, it rolled under the counter there.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy said, I'm not bending over and reaching under the counter for a quarter. Well, you know, if you don't want to, okay. So then they got on their stuff, and they walked out.
Yeah.
This guy, who's 75 years old, bent over, reached under, got the quarter, and put it in his pocket. And that's why he's got $10 to $15 million. Because he pays attention to it.
Yep, that's so true. The way to stay rich is to manage your money and actually pay attention to it.
Don't walk away from it.
Yeah, that is so true. I feel like we got a lot of material covered. And I'm glad I had this conversation, even for me to learn a lot. My very last question, and you can always add more if you would like to, but my very last question, and I'm always intrigued because people have different definitions, but for you, what is the definition of success?
What is the definition of success? Well, you mean in the short run, or do you mean in your entire life, or what?
It's completely up to you. Like, when you say you're successful, when would you consider yourself successful?
You're happy for the right reasons, and the people you love are happy for the right reasons. And the people you affect are happy for the right reasons.
See, I love the answers because all the interviews that I've had so far, whenever I ask this question, people say one way or another, it's all about the inner peace, being happy, you know, not stressing out. Compared to other people, sometimes I feel like they've reached success if they have $1 million on their bank. But
$1 million doesn't go the way it used to.
So it's more of being happy and with what you do, and
happy, satisfied would be content. Maybe that would be better than happy. But if you're living a life, and I live that life now where I'm happy.
Mm-hmm.
If I drop dead tonight, I die happy. I've got family that are all doing well. And the people that I work with, I think that I add some value to their lives, bring a little sunshine into their life. And students, I generally do well with students. So I feel like the people I encounter, I add a little plus to their life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really all any of us can say, is that we left a little impression on the world while we were here. Because I guarantee you that when you get to be over 70, you will say, wait a minute, I was born, and then I blinked, and it was over.
So you joke about death, because you said earlier, well, I'm good today, I woke up, so yeah. I'm still here. And now you said, if I die tomorrow, like, death doesn't scare you?
No.
No?
The only thing about death that would concern me is, do we have enough things set up so that my wife would be comfortable for the rest of her life, because she's quite a bit younger than me.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make sure that she's comfortable. And I know the kids are well into their careers. They're doing fine. But that'd be the only thing. But, you know, nah, it's no big deal.
Is that maybe why you're doing, like, multiple things all at once? Because you just want to enjoy it and you feel like you get enjoyment from everything you do from life?
If I don't enjoy something, I stop doing it.
You just completely drop out and don't do it.
Once you get to be over 60 or 70,
uh-huh,
then you say, if I'm not enjoying it, I don't do it.
I got a little way to go there, yeah.
Well, you have to eat a little bit of it on the front end. And then when you get on the back end, you say, nope. I was waiting to go into a men's room, and some woman came out of the women's room. It was a one-holer, okay?
Uh-huh.
So a woman comes out of the restroom, so I go walking in. She said, that's the women's room. I said, I'm 70 years old. I'm going in. I said, you can call the police if you want to. I went in there, did my business, came out. I was fine. The woman glared at me.
Was this recently? Was this recently?
About a month ago.
About a month ago. I feel like that's something my dad would do. Just be like, nope, the line is too long. I'm not doing that. But like, ignore me. All right, bye, y'all.
That's exactly right. So that's my definition of success, is just being a positive influence on the people in the world around me. And there's so much happening in the world. I mean, we are learning so much that we wouldn't even imagine 5 years ago. All you have to do is look up something called entanglement.
Mm-hmm.
Look up something called superposition. Have you experienced those?
No.
Get into that. You'll find that there's things that are just almost impossible to believe. And they've been around for almost 100 years.
What was it, entanglement?
Entanglement.
What was the other one?
Well, just get entanglement first.
And okay.
Then you can see that. But entanglement is the idea that things that are completely far apart are connected subconsciously. And, for example, birds in Norway that fly to the north coast of Africa for the winter,
mm-hmm,
one bird leaves early, goes down there and finds the best place to build a nest. And it's different every year where they go. That one bird goes down there, and the minute that bird starts building a nest, the other birds all leave Norway and start down, and they can make a beeline for that particular bird. Now, how do they know where that bird is? It's not the same place every year.
Yeah.
And they got like a 1,000-mile coastline where
Correct.
They could be going. And that's what entanglement is. And the same thing happens with quantum physics. So there's a lot of things like that we're just finding out that we didn't know.
I'm going to look into that. That's very interesting.
It is. It just tells us that we find out that we know less than what we thought we know.
And the more you learn, the more you find out how much you don't know.
Yeah. We find that we get one more step forward.
Yeah.
Then we find out that there's 50 more steps out there that we didn't know about.
That is so true. That is so true. You feel like you just enlighten yourself with a new topic, and then you're like, but I don't know this 100 other topics that are related to this one.
You won't be able to study them all, but just pick a few.
And pick your favorites.
For me, it's quantum physics,
mm-hmm,
and quantum physics is probably my best one, because I really get into that. And when I get into it, and because I've studied it most of my life, and it's just amazing what is found. In fact, Einstein said about quantum physics, you're better off if you don't think about it too much. That's what Einstein said. So, and he's right. They had one thing that happened. They were trying to measure photons going through a slit in metal,
mm-hmm,
and then when it got to the back wall, it would either make a very tight list or a very tight line of bright photons from the light, or it would make waves, because there was a slit here, a slit here.
Mm-hmm.
So they would, if it was waves, then it would be wavy all the way across. If they were particles, then they would just be two slits with nothing in between. So they said, we know that they have waves because we've seen that before. We also think they're particles. So they would do it, and they were testing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then what they found was they had a camera set up on both sides to record all this. And then one of the scientists said, let's step outside. So they stepped outside and talked. They said, whenever we turn the camera on, the photons act differently. So if we have the camera off, some of them will act like particles. But if we turn the camera on, then they won't act like particles anymore. They act like waves. They said, well, is that because there's some kind of magnetic or something going mm-hmm. on? So, but we'll figure that out. So they got a big, thick piece of plexiglass
mm-hmm.
that nothing could get through. And so they put that there, and then they had the camera set up so that there was like a magnetic barrier there that nothing in the camera would get through. You'd just be able to see through it.
Yeah.
And so they did the same thing again. And they saw that it continued happening. Then they said, okay, we're going to have the camera set up as if it's working. And then somebody would go over, and while the camera was running, one of the scientists would reach over and pull the plug on the camera. And the minute he pulled the plug, it started behaving again the old way. You think, this is creepy.
Yeah.
So that's... And I don't know if you know Shauna Corum. She's one of our accounting professors. Her daughter is absolutely brilliant. And she's going to UCLA this fall to study neuroscience and quantum physics. Because I started talking to her about it.
Mm-hmm.
Shauna said, thanks a lot. I was going to have her become an accountant like me, and we're going to have our own business. I said, I can't help what she does.
Yeah.
And so she started reading about it, about quantum. She said, I got to do this. And she said, this is something I'm going to have to do. So now she's going to be a quantum physicist.
That's amazing. I haven't really studied quantum physics, and I'm not very well educated in it.
Well, you can read. I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there.
Yeah.
And the only thing different is that if you want to be a physicist, then you've got to learn all the math. And there's weird math in it. It's not just calculus and differential equation.
Mm-hmm.
Get into topography and all these other things that are just way out there. But if you just want to read it without understanding the physics, which is real easy to do,
yeah,
you just buy the books on it, and it'll tell you what's happening.
And I'm going to look into that. I have to look for stock investment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to look into quantum physics and entanglement.
Now, if you look for stock investments, let me caution you that you will find hundreds of books.
Mm-hmm.
They'll each tell you different
things.
Well,
I'm going to read yours because I still haven't read yours.
Okay.
So I'm going to start with yours first, which is the professor's 1-minute guide to stock management.
Okay.
So I'm going to start with yours first.
I'll give you back your microphone. it's a good one, but it's discipline in there. You have to be very disciplined to use it. If you're going to have the time every day
mm-hmm.
to look at it, then that's good. But if you don't have time every day to look at it 2-3 times a day,
mm-hmm.
then... you got to be careful. So.
I see.
So in my case, I have a little bit that I play with every day, but then I have most of my stuff. I have it just on autopilot with the total stock market fund and the total global fund. I just let it roll.
And how long you've been doing that for?
How long I've been using those funds or the?
The funds, yeah.
Oh, about 20 years. Do you know John Lyon by any chance?
Mm-mm.
Professor of finance. And
well, guys, I hope you learned as much as I did during this podcast. Dr. Harvey, it's always a pleasure to talk to. I did end up cutting the conversation as we did mention more names to be more specific throughout surroundings and all of us. And we do not really have permission to have that under recording. That's why the shortcut is made. But do not forget to check back on us next week. And for any updates, you can always go to rmpodcastfl.com. Hope you guys have a great rest of the day. Bye.